This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are listening to Canadian scientist Dr. Bill Rees from the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, October 21st, 2009. The co-inventor of the eco-footprint, Bill Rees, is now warning that humans are consuming the planet to death.
There are dozens of studies you never read about in the news that talk about these consequences. Here are quotes from two of them. The Age of Consequences, we predict an inevitable scenario in which people and nations are threatened by, etc. I won't read these, but the point is, why aren't we paying attention? These are high-powered, high-paid studies of the social consequences of global change. What we mean, or what this all boils down to, and again, keep in mind, I'm assuming the science is right, I'm assuming we want to survive. The only thing we need to think about is how do we reduce our absolute contribution drivers here. And again, it goes way back to an International Business Council on Sustainable Development meeting in Antwerp in 1993 that said, look, the data suggests, even then, that it's a 90% reduction in energy and material throughput in rich countries, because in order to create the ecological space, in my terminology, the eco-footprints of the rich countries have already appropriated most of the biocapacity of the planet to make room for those. The UN last week announced that officially now 1 billion people are in starvation, badly malnourished. That's the largest number ever in the history of the planet, and more people who were alive than were alive when Malthus wrote his original essay. That's the situation we're facing. And we aren't conscious of it because it's over there somewhere. But they say a 90% reduction. Our ecological footprint work says that if we're going to have sustainability with equity on a single planet that is shrinking, then we in North America should be working now to devise the social safety nets, the structural changes necessary to bring our per capita eco-footprints down from an average of 9 in North America to about 2 per capita. Now, cities have a huge leg up in doing this. I'm a great fan of density. I was somewhat behind the eco-density movement in Vancouver here, advising the mayor with a group of my students on how we might conceive of that. I know some of you have difficulty with the equity aspects of it, but that can be taken care of. The point is, there's all kinds of economies of scale and agglomeration economies that emerge from higher density. These slides are freely available to anyone who wants them, so I'm not going to read this. But we need to go further. Efficiency is not enough. All the eco-density stuff is efficiency-oriented. We really need to rethink the city as the human ecosystem. We need to reconceive them and redesign them to incorporate as much of their supportive ecosystems within their own political jurisdictions as is possible. If you know that you are dependent on that acre, you will not permit unwarranted greenfield development on that acre. We are paving over the Fraser Valley despite the land reserves because we assume we can always import our food from elsewhere. The elsewhere is mostly California, which if you speak to people from California are now saying we may not have any agriculture in 50 years at the rate the water is drying up. They've had to shut down tens of thousands of hectares this year because there is no water. We have a very, very limited view of our own sustainability if we continue to think we can continue to, in a sec, parasitize other places simply because we have the money to do so. So we have conceptual models, bioregionalism, learning to live more or less off the land base in your region, permaculture, which would double the productivity of our land base without having to resort to chemical pesticides and fertilizers and all of that sort of thing. So I'm thinking we really have to think 50 years ahead in terms of reconceiving the city as an urban-centered eco-city state. The provinces are obsolete. The Canadian Constitution makes no reference to communities, to cities. It's provinces and the federal government. But most of us now live in cities. Why not reorganize our settlements so that they are in charge of a significant resource base in their vicinity? Wouldn't work for a place like Tokyo. Tokyo needs other kinds of arrangements. But Canada, parts of the United States, are capable of thinking this way. This is really going outside of the box so that we can claim this urban system as a complete self-referencing, self-producing, self-sustaining, self-supporting entity that is not dependent so much on other places. It doesn't mean no trade, because if we have a network of these kinds of interdependent regions, they can exchange, but they exchange in terms of true ecological surpluses. And that's where we should be going. And it's actually an old idea, going back to some of the great planners, Patrick Geddes, Lewis Mumford, Ebenezer Howard, and so on. Now, a lot of people say, God, that bugger's so, depressing. And listen, this is the good news. And I just want to take you through it. I'm saying the science looks good to me because it's just unfolding exactly as we've said it would all along. So if we stay the course, in other words, business as usual, we're going to get accelerated resource depletion, accelerating global change, climate chaos, greater systemic pollution, economic uncertainty. Hey, we've had a lot of great economic stuff, coming out of mainstream recently. A widening income gap, which is steadily happening all over the planet, including in our own country. Increasing civil unrest, potential geopolitical chaos, and possible cultural collapse. Now, there's a really neat scenario for you. And it comes right out of doing nothing, which is what most of our politicians would like to have us do. On the other hand, if we take seriously the science and move toward an eco-transformation of sorts, we might get conservation and restoration of the essential natural capital we need to sustain ourselves, agricultural soils, forests, water supplies, and so on and so forth. We would have cleaner air, soil, and water. We would have a higher degree of economic security because we would plan social safety nets so that people who are being displaced from sunset industries into more sustainable forms of development have that transition support from the rest of the community. We need to recreate community is a message that's coming across here, which means narrowing the income gap. We need greater social capital and sense of community, greater political or geopolitical stability. See, down this path on the left, we're going to be at war within 40 years over the declining resource base. It's already beginning to appear in such things as Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. So we need to move towards the right because the pressures are real and we'll be better off for it. So again, this is the good news story. The political conundrum is the following. We can't muster the will to move toward eco-transformation. And it has to do with cognitive dissonance, something else that Nola Kate mentioned. Human beings evolved such that as a person develops individually in a society, we take on the baggage of that society, the political ideologies, the ways of thinking, the Cartesian dualism I spoke about at the middle. And it actually helps to shape synaptic circuitry in the brain. And once that's in place, it's very difficult to shift out of it. Nola Kate mentioned, we don't like change. Well, this is why we don't like change. It's, in a sense, hardwired by your individual development. And once it's hardwired, we seek out experiences that reinforce what we already think. That's why most of you are in this room, by the way. And we avoid, deny, or otherwise denigrate anything we don't want to hear about. And that's how we act. So we're always resistant to change because if it worked for my grandfather, it worked for me. And by the way, that was an adaptive strategy 3,000 years ago. If you survived in a tribal circumstance, it's because they were doing something right. Better to take on that burden. But now it doesn't work because the very circumstances that we have created comes from thinking is destructive. And if we take on that thinking, we'll just carry on down this path. We really need to shift. The problem is, what's ecologically necessary is politically unfeasible, but what's politically feasible, look at what we're doing in this country. We don't even have a climate policy, is ecologically irrelevant and will get us nowhere. So be the change, as someone has already said. And by the way, good luck. Thanks very much.
You have just heard a keynote presentation from the 2009 Gaining Ground Summit in Vancouver, British Columbia, held October 20th to 22nd. That was Dr. Bill Rees, co-inventor of the Ecological Footprint. The meeting theme was Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times. Bill Rees spoke on Planning Down, What If Can Do Can't. This recording is by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find this and other speeches as free MP3 downloads in the Cities section of our audio on-demand menu at ecoshock.org. For more information and video of the Resilient Cities Conference, go to www.gainingground summit.com. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Find lots of free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. If you scroll down a bit on our main page, try out the Audio On Demand menu. The Resilient Cities Conference recordings are on our Cities page, of course. EcoShock.org is one of the net's largest free download sites for the environment. Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive. Bill Rees is normally a mild-mannered man. Recently, he told a Peak Oil crowd he'd rather be playing his oboe in a wind quartet than worrying about the future of the world. But Bill's a facts-are-facts kind of guy, and he's upset about our prospects. For example, let's explore a dialogue between Bill Rees and Warren Karlentzig, the California Green Cities guru, about China's green announcements. Karlentzig, whose Green a City blog tends to find the positive, has been exploring Chinese development. Is China headed toward new eco-cities or plunging into an environmental nightmare, or both? Karlentzig and Rees debated the future of China in a question-and-answer period recorded at the Post-Carbon Cities presentation October 20th in Vancouver. Warren Karlentzig begins to answer a question from the audience about their conflicting sense of China's ecological direction.
Well, the overshoot is absolutely there, and it is scary when you see the scale of overshoot. It dwarfs anything that we could comprehend. It's depressing, you know, that it. But what gives me some optimism is that China is looking at these 40 new eco-cities, and these are going to be major population centers. When China does things, it does it huge. They have the state planning agencies behind it. They have complete buy-in, and it's very different than zoning or planning in the United States. In most Asian countries, it's very different. So there is hope there that they are getting it, even more than the United States in some regards, the resiliency issue. But yes, the consumerism, the moving up the consumption ladder to emulate the United States, that's definitely there. You know, 3 years ago in Asia, a green city to them meant parks and open space. It was kind of like the 1970s conception in North America of what a green city was. And then I tried to, you know, bring concepts of land use planning, transit, you know, all these renewable energy, and that's part of it too. Oh, and now they understand that green buildings definitely part of it in a lot of the countries. They understand these other issues too, but the public doesn't, and that's a big issue there. So the media is completely different there. You know, they don't really publicize the green movement like they do in the United States. So there's a big disconnect there. But China, I think, will change. They have to change, and they know it. They look at the long-term picture in China in particular. They look at dynasties. They look at hundreds and thousands of years, and they're doing that now with energy, with the automobile, with water. I didn't mention the Tibetan plateau is 40% reduced, and that's where the six major rivers of Asia all come from. So it's scary in many ways, but there is some hope.
I just want to build on the scary part and maybe the hope part. Part of the Beijing area is drying up. Beijing may have to move. Yeah. I'm serious. This is not, we're not joking around here.
Next year, it's going to be the water crisis of 2010 is going to hit the public consciousness and the international media. They're stealing water from outlying districts and communities or taking it, expropriating it, and bringing it into Beijing. It's a race again, and they're trying to build a diversion canal from the south to the north, and it has no planned completion date. So they have enough water for 14 million people. Now there are, I think, 18 or 19 million people in the city.
And keep in mind, in China, if you move all that water to support the 14 million people in Beijing, you're taking it away from the 6 million people who live in the areas that you're drawing down to bring that water in. So China has inordinate problems. One half of all the new construction of buildings in the world today is taking place in China. And for the most part, now I totally agree there's a lot of planning for so-called eco-cities, but for the most part, Chinese construction is the least efficient and most concrete intensive on the planet. So one half of all new construction is taking place in China using concrete, which is enormously carbon intensive, and the buildings are not built to a high degree of efficiency or any other standard that we would accept for the most part. Moreover, most of that construction is residential, which has the highest density of concrete compared to warehousing and that sort of thing. So the impact of Chinese construction in and of itself, even if it's green, is going to be inordinately huge. And if we were really sensible about our own future, we'd be doing everything we can to share with China the absolute top end of our design capabilities, our building capabilities, to make sure that this one half of all the world's new construction is built at the highest possible standard with the lowest possible carbon footprint. But unfortunately, we're not doing that. I've seen at least one major new so-called eco-city in China. It's a catastrophic mistake in many respects. They've got the housing for the workers over here, the work sites completely on the opposite side of the city over here, and the way to get between them is through, guess what, mostly automobiles. So we've got huge problems to deal with, even in China, even with a lot of the eco-thinking that's going on down there. There's been some spectacular failures that we could talk about if we wanted to. I mean, you've got to face it the way it is. I'll give an example of a very famous one that isn't built yet. It's been stalled for a variety of reasons. It's called Dongtang. Have any of you heard of Dongtang? Well, all right. So it's a high density. It will be a new city. It will, because of the high density, it gets some of the economies of scale associated with large urban areas. But it's a suburb of Shanghai, and the only access to it is either by luxury boat, because every dwelling in Dongtang has a marina, or car. It's also located in a prime waterfowl area and covering agricultural land. So when I raise this with the developers, no worry, we're going to build greenhouses to replace the agricultural land. But we've studied greenhouses to the nth degree of the kind they're talking about. They use 14 times as much inputs per unit product as a field-grown vegetable in that kind of climate area. So it's not a substitute. They do have, you know, wind power and solar photovoltaics. But, you know, the jury's still out even on photovoltaics yet as to whether over the long term it's a net energy source for a whole variety of reasons. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do it for this application or for that application. But it does mean that if you're going to do it as a major source of energy for any extended period of time, you better be very careful about the circumstances in which you're putting it. So there's many reasons to be doubtful and optimistic about the Dongtang kind of development. But it's not going ahead at this point in any case. Another one, I already mentioned one that I saw. It was just a complete planning disaster. And it's fully constructed.
Yeah, Dongtang is not going to happen at all. There was corruption, and it's just not going to be built. It was ballyhooed around the world for a few years, and it's not happening. Tianjin looks to be the most likely first model of the new eco-city that they're going to build, and a district of Tianjin, and that's one of the 40 new eco-city districts I mentioned. Some of the metrics they have now for these districts, and these districts will be up to 500,000 people, are 90% walkability, bikeability, and public transit use. So 10% automobile use within these districts. They're going for 20% renewable energy, not very much at all. I mean, California is shooting for 30% by 2020. In fact, it's state law. California is going to have 30% all renewable energy by 2020. So they're all, you know, it's very minimal goal of renewable, so because they're so dependent on coal in China for power. There's not much in terms of local food. They are going to try to do some things with local food in Tianjin. The metrics are cloudy, though. They're very, you know. So those are that's what stands out to me. Green building principles. China is developing the 3-star standard. They're finalizing, or they're going to try to finalize that within the next year. It's their own green building standard. So it looks like there's going to be 3 international green building standards. There's going to be LEED, there's going to be China's 3-star, and then the European standard, BREEAM. So that's where China is with their metrics right now. They need a lot of help there, but they're really willing to look at a lot of people's ideas right now. One firm, I can't mention who they are, they're developing a prototype of a city of like 20,000 people that could scale up to 1 million using renewable energy, geothermal energy, and they control the technology in this one area. It could be feasible. Greenhouses being heated with solar, thermal energy, not PV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they've looked at algae as a fuel source, as an energy source, and as a waste. You know, it's a circular ecosystem in some ways. And the Chinese are interested in this company's or this outfit's approach. They're also looking at worldwide. There are cities being designed now that can withstand floods. Especially in Indonesia, there's a city of 500,000 that might have to be rebuilt because it sits at the confluence of about 15 rivers and the water's rising. So the new vernacular for architecture for cities near the ocean is going to be a 5-meter lower level that's sort of expendable. And the Chinese are considering that with their coastal cities as well now. They're looking at everything, which to their credit is something that, you know, a country like the United States would say, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that's silly and you're crazy. China is saying, well, yeah, I mean, this could happen, or we're building cities for 50 years. These are the inputs we need to look at. So there's a lot more to that.
I just have to add a couple of points here.
Again, please make it quick, though, because we've got only 15 minutes.
Without taking anything away of what Warren said, every increment of growth in China is based on the idea of rising incomes. And it doesn't matter how they build the cities. Even if they're 50% more efficient than they would otherwise have been, it's on top of what's already out there, which is already too much. What the world needs is an 80% reduction in absolute terms in its material and energy throughput. And that's basically fossil fuel use. Growing more sustainably doesn't cut it. Lead is growth. It doesn't cut it. It's growing more sustainably. Getting more efficiently unsustainable doesn't cut it.
You've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We just heard from Bill Reese that more growth, even if you call it green growth or sustainable growth, is just more consumption of a planet already on its last legs of biological support. Bill's dialogue with Warren Karlenzig was recorded at a panel presented by the Post-Carbon Institute. From that same question and answer period, available on the Cities page at ecoshock.org, we hear Bill Reese tackle the question of pessimism, optimism, and realism when it comes to the fate of our world.
Sometimes people call me a pessimist. This is an important point, because I'm not a pessimist, I'm not an optimist. These are just states of mind that have nothing to do with reality. Okay, you can be as pessimistic as you like. It's not going to change anything if the world's on a golden course. Or you can be as optimistic as you like, and if you're a passenger on the Titanic, you're going to sink anyway. So we want to be realistic in sizing up our situation. And I do that by looking at the numbers. And as I guess Dan mentioned, I have been doing this for some 40 years. The numbers are not getting better. That's just the truth. I'm not trying to make a bad story of it or depress you. But if you don't realize they're getting worse, you don't have a chance to respond to the circumstances in which we are going to find ourselves. So realism simply means opening the opportunity to respond to the real world as it comes at us. And one of the things that's preventing you from finding out about reality is the way we've structured this world so that people who have long since overshot their carrying capacity and live in inherently unsustainable environments are blinded from that reality by the flows of goods and services from other places that they're drawing it down, and so on and so forth. This is not a scenario that is positive. What I'm saying to you is that what is depressing is the way the world is going, the status quo, the business as usual, which is driving these trends that I continue to measure, is a depressing scenario. And I'm trying to break through that and say, look, if we accept these data for what they say and act accordingly, we can pull it off by restructuring our cities in ways that will enable us to survive and to have a future in a sustainable, steady state with a degree of equity that makes life reasonably pleasant for those of us who survive these circumstances. That's optimism. It's not pessimism. That's the first point. The second point is, how many of you have learned or heard about the shipload of Sri Lankans who arrived on our shores in the last couple of days? It reminds us once again that we in North America live in the world's last bliss bubble. Every other place on the planet is overcrowded and depleted. And we only live the way we do because this vast, relatively empty continent, with apologies to the First Nations people, was an inordinate resource warehouse that has sustained Europe and all of us in North America in a material style that has never before been seen on planet Earth. But as I said, we use up all the resources. We are dissipating it as fast as we possibly can without pausing for breath on the growth trajectory that we all think is the norm. So again, that's the truth. Wake up to it. Because other people are beginning to see what we've got and want it in places that can't possibly get it. We have created a mythic model that cannot be sustained on this planet. If everyone lived the way we do, we'd need at least 3 and possibly 4 additional Earth-like planets to achieve that sustainably. It cannot happen on this single planet Earth. So we'd better change our ways and project a model to the other 6.5 billion people on this planet that could be sustained. And it's not the one that they're getting from us. We are not radiating the proper message. The bottom line is that if, let's say, if the climate change scenarios are correct, if peak oil is true, there will be, in the lifetimes of many of you in this room, hundreds of millions, if not billions, of refugees on this planet seeking out the best places to go. And they will come, whether we like it or not, by any means possible. And by the way, that includes Americans coming up here to get our energy and everything else that we need to sustain what's left of the United States. Because if the 3- and 4-degree warming scenario, which is now being commonly accepted, it's the most recent study out of Hadley just this week, takes place, then 1/2 of the United States is uninhabitable by the latter part of this century. And that means 200 million people looking for somewhere else to go. So people, this is not, you know, a minor little shift in consciousness. This requires some really hard thinking about what the hell we're going to do in these kinds of circumstances. We create cities today whose basic form will be in place in 50 years. The city we have today, oh, there's a few new buildings, but the form was set 50 years ago. So we need to think 50 years ahead about our urban form and how we're going to live and where the agricultural land is going to be to sustain whatever population it is and so on and so forth. And oh, by the way, what about the 2 million other people who want to move into the neighborhood when India goes belly up or whatever? That's the nature of the game, if the science is correct. Nobody knows for sure, but it sure as hell is playing out the way we said it would 10, 15 years ago.
This concludes our special on the thoughts and warnings of Dr. Bill Rees, a longtime professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. In the 1990s, Rees and his student Matthias Wackernagel originated the idea of the ecological footprint. Rees continued his strident analysis of growth, world economic development, and environmental resources. In his latest work, he explains why the North American model of growth will destroy Earth's ecology unless it is cut back quickly. He says we need to reduce our consumption by 80%. Bill Rees can bring out endless charts and discussion leading to this one idea. Our current model is unsustainable, perhaps deadly. Continued growth leads to a steep decline. We can blunder into that catastrophe or try to manage it. Smart decline. I'm Alex Smith. Visit our website for all our past programs, ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.